Hi, this is Bill Teeple. I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. So Donna, oops, Alan's going to make an announcement.
Oh yes, I just wanted to mention that in case the show sounds a little bit echoey today, it's nearing the end of the season, and we've drained the Icon Gallery swimming pool, and we've decided to record the next few shows here in the swimming pool. I'm at the deep end, and Bill and Donna are up closer to the shallow end. And we hope you enjoy the changed sonic quality of our show today.
And the audience's quest now is to find out where the Icon swimming pool actually is.
Yes, yes. If you can find the swimming pool, you'll get a free pass to the next Icon Odd Thursday. And the hint that you should take away with you is there's no water in it.
All right. Thank you for that.
My pleasure.
We've clarified everything for everyone, haven't we? So Donna, what's this book?
Oh, this is a fabulous book that I just ordered, just discovered. It's called In Paul Klee's Enchanted Garden, and I've barely begun reading it, so I can't tell you a lot about the whole book, but it talks a lot about, it gives many journal entries from when he was young and was an avid gardener and nature aficionado. And the main point of this book is to show how deeply connected to nature all of his work was throughout his career. So I wanted to read a couple of quotes from the beginning part that kind of gives a chronology of his life and his connection with nature. And it it has a lot of stories about when he was in his 20s and he discovered, he lived in the country and really did a lot of gardening every day. And he said it was just brought him great joy. And he felt the best when he felt like a plant himself, that it was the only way to feel properly at home. So the two quotes I want to read are later, like 20 years after that period of time when his career was getting, you know, a lot of publicity. And one quote writer said, once again, he's talking about Klee's work. Once again, art transforms itself into the balanced wholeness of a seed in which everything sprouts from the earth slowly and unerringly, purely, like the sparkling architecture of a cathedral. And then another one, written a year later, says, on some solemn night, Klee planted in the most secret of places the germ of his self-contained selfhood. From then on, all the threads that he had meant to spin turned into tender roots. And what he has since been able to draw out of his soul, has become rootedness. He is said to have spent a solar year in Tunisia. The plant shot up at once. Now it is putting forth flowers, his fiery watercolors. But the self is developing further. When Klee draws, new roots sprout forth, and colorful flowers emerge when he paints, poetry composed in colors.
It's fantastic. And it so amplifies everything we've been, the conclusions we've been coming to, whatever degree we've come to any kind of conclusion as to what this process is all about. But it seems to be more, we've come to understand, I believe, that it's more of a process of deepening our connection with source, or in this case, the metaphor is putting down roots. Mm-hmm. And the deeper the roots go and connect and explore, the more the potentiality for the flowering comes. It's a beautiful quote.
Yeah, that's what struck me about it when it talked about he was trying to spin threads, and then at a certain point, the threads became roots. That was a real wonderful distinction, I thought, that this writer made, because we can spend years, and artists can spend years in the thread spinning realm without going to those deeper places.
Well, isn't that sort of a perfect metaphor for postmodern art? It's
absolutely
all spinning and no roots.
It's where we've ended up. I think that I've talked about this before. I feel like the whole trajectory of exploration of deeper and deeper knowledge through art really actually kind of culminated in the modernist period, where we really were connecting with the deepest levels of connection to source. And then it sort of like gave way to a more surface level during the postmodern period. But now I believe that the role of icon is this very thing we're talking about today.
Yeah.
And that this quote is like it could be a banner that we hold forth in front of us as we march forward into the art of the 21st century.
Because why do you think the shift took place from the modernists, the artists who were really going deeply into their inner worlds, to what happened with the postmodern era? Why did that shift take place, do you think?
I think it came from a total misunderstanding of what the Impressionists were doing. I think people were shocked by the emergence of non-representational art, and they looked at it as newness, and they didn't see it as an expression. They didn't see it as abstract expressionism. They saw it as abstract expressionism. And so the people who were imitating it were able to successfully pass themselves off as innovators.
So they abstracted.
It created a whole school of stuff that's different, and we now have a cult of the new, which is
it kind of is an extension of the concept of avant-garde, which happened with the turn of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And once the art lost its meaning as a documentation of society and history through being superseded by photography, then artists had to find a new, deeper meaning for artistic expression, or connect again with its former meanings as artistic expression. And this exploration led to looking into all of the corners of our being and our souls and what means anything to us. And these expressions emerged, these flowers emerged from that deepening and looking. Then it became the concept of the avant-garde became this anything that's new is valuable, which is what you just said. And so the originality, as it was called, tended to be what everyone was looking for, doing something that was different than ever been done before. And somehow that brought us right up to the surface. We're exploring the surface of the pond, every little nook and cranny of different ways of expressing ourselves, and we've lost contact with this search for deeper connectedness.
Well, and that's actually something that maybe is just a natural thing that goes on, where, like in the Romantic period, when the artists of Romanticism and the writers of Romanticism were going against the traditions of the classical era, they had a real reason for doing that. They wanted to bring out something, you know, that they were feeling and bring that out into their work more. But to a lot of younger people who were influenced by that, it just seemed like a weird kind of rebellious thing that, hey, you can do anything you want. And so a lot of shallow artists then came out of the Romantic era
This is just the cycle of progress, of evolution, really, but especially evolution in the arts. There's always a kind of crystalline, things get crystallized, and then someone, you know, sees through that to source of experience, to the foundation of reality, and this crystalline structure, breaks them out of the crystalline structure, so they're able to see things anew and fresh, and they just innocently start talking about this way of seeing that's not all bound by this crystalline structure, and then a whole new wave of art comes out of that whole phase of art. But soon enough, artists start imitating the surface style, and then we've gotten into, and it becomes crystallized into everyone sees this as art, and then someone has to break through again.
And it's probably not fair to generalize anyway. Like in the postmodern era, I'm sure there are many artists who are going deeply very rooted in source and all. But the ones that get the publicity and the little blurbs in the New Yorker gallery descriptions tend to be the ones that are, captivating, are the most unique and original and strange.
And also we're talking about a phenomenon in culture, not just in the arts. This surface level and this interest in, surface rewards of money and fame and fortune and beating out and all of these kinds of things have dominated culture, and we've seen a kind of very materialist period in culture, especially since in the 80s, and the arts have paralyzed that. So the people that are the brokers of the art, if they have that level of consciousness, mm-hmm. that level of awareness, they're going to emphasize the new, hot, sexy stuff. This is even talked about in the art world today. Some of the old veterans who are making art that is just built around quality and craftsmanship and experience and maturity. This type of work isn't getting play in the art magazines and stuff because the editors and all are sort of wowed by this other thing themselves. Mm.
And as you were talking too, I was thinking, about the materialistic era and what kind of art that generated. I thought there have been artists even who have tapped into the beauty of material. Like Fernand Léger was an artist who, in the industrial age, he just felt like factories and machines had beauty as well.
He sent down his roots.
Yeah.
And probably everyone around him was bemoaning the industrial age. He stuck down roots enough to be able to look at it and see it in a bigger picture mm-hmm. as something beautiful.
Because he seemed to be like a magical soul, in his things that you hear him writing about his work too, that he saw, I guess, that's just another expression of life. Sorry, Alan,
I interrupted. There's nothing materialistic about machinery.
That's right.
Materialism is an attitude of humans, and a machine is a work of creativity.
Mm,
so it's it's interesting that there isn't more art focused on man-made materialistic subjects. We do up to a point. We do portraits, and we do portraits with clothing of, where a tremendous amount of creativity and skill goes in the portrait painting goes into the clothing and the surroundings. And when you look at the classic portraiture of the Renaissance, it's the room that's almost more important than the person who's being painted, and what they're wearing is crucial to the thing. So even that is an illustration, in a sense, of supreme egocentric, posturing within society, but mm-hmm. it's through the eyes of an artist who's highly skillful, and it's fine. Mm-hmm. Architectural renderings, they've become so stylized that they're not much, there isn't much appeal as pure fine art now, but there's no reason why they couldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's sort of ironic, I guess, that even something as almost supremely mechanical in its appearance or construction as Lawrence Schieff's paintings, his whole purpose in painting them is completely transcendental. And yet the painting itself is extremely geometric. Mm. And he's thinking about the abstractions of geometry and the way that geometry reflects cosmic reality and so on. But I imagine the average viewer is thinking, wow, that's very geometric. And the feeling they get from it may be transcendental, but it may take a while to notice that.
I gotta say this because it's just, I'll lose it. A tree, you know, it's so much of this has to do with these constructs and concepts we create in our brains about things that make them positive or negative. A tree is the most complex and interesting machine you could possibly imagine. And the same intelligence that structured that tree structured all those refineries and things that maybe Leger liked with pipes and stuff. He was commenting on a very lesser level of the unfoldment of this kind of intelligence materially, but saw that it was beautiful to him.
Yes.
But a tree is taking it to a much greater degree of complexity.
Who was that wonderful photographer that had a show in Gallery 51 of photographs of earthworks? What was so great about it?
Well, David Hansen?
I don't think it was David Hansen. These were photos of strip mines and chemical dumps and things.
Well, where David Hansen did that body of work.
That
and
was
so there. We didn't show a complete show of that because he's now doing these sacred places.
Yeah.
But his reputation was built on the works that were published in the book called Wasteland.
It was a
watershed work, we might say. because he was one of the people that really brought to the attention of the public, this was a widely published book, of how beautiful the world is, how we've disturbed it, and that's disturbing, but at the same time, it's like the beauty can't be suppressed, that nature...
Well, that's what I was driving at. The fact that these images, if you don't know the story behind the image, it's a beautiful green and brown and red lake. And only after you find out that it's green and brown and red because it's full of, toxic chemicals and sludge and runoff, and it would kill you if you got within 100 feet of it, then you have this interesting juxtaposition of reactions because it's a horrible thing, but it's beautiful.
But you know what this brings up? This brings up the consideration of nature itself.
Yes.
Because the artist stands before nature in awe of its beauty.
Yes.
And he's painting the beautiful sea and the seas, the beautiful trees and the sea and the lakes and the animals and the sky and all of this. And yet it is an absolute paradox of opposing forces in its entire potential array unfolding before our eyes, which means it's both terrible and sublime at the same time.
Yes.
There's all this rotting, everything that you just described about David's picture of a strip mine or something with its toxic runoff and stuff, nature is just full of this element of decay and what we might call ugliness and disturbing smells and all of that.
Yeah.
And yet, man hasn't quite gotten into stride, although he's already in stride. He can't get out of stride with this disturbing strip mine. It's like maybe offensive to someone living there or offensive to our ecosystem, but it still is part of an evolving system that can't be outside of perfection. But when we look at the nature before us unfolding and happening with all of the predators and everything going on and this rotting stuff and the beautiful unfolding flower, it's all an incredible system that is both. And then the idea, and we also can say, oh, it's so nice to think of wandering or living in a tent in a teepee in the woods. But if you've ever tried to do that, you realize that surviving in the fluctuating qualities of nature with all of the elements to deal with is a fairly daunting thing. But there's this like pulsating rhythm of pulsating one thing against the other, the beauty and the terrible all at once. And it's just the name of relative existence.
Entirely, yeah.
Did you ever see that series of called Planet Earth? BBC
I saw
made
bits of it, yeah.
Absolutely magnificent. And it shows with exquisite photography and technology they hadn't had available before, just exactly what you were talking about, the full range of nature. And it's done in segments, like there'll be one on the sea, the deep sea, one on the shallow waters, one on the caves, one on the mountains. And I would highly recommend it because it's very...
I think I may have mentioned this in another show, but it's apropos. It was a presentation on the lions of the Kalahari, and what struck me was, first of all, it's difficult for a lot of animal lovers to accept the fact that in nature, a huge proportion of animals, not, you know, animals on a farm, but in nature, a huge proportion of animals die from being killed by other animals. They get torn apart while they're still alive, and it's not a pretty thought for us because we're kind of out of nature in our sensibilities. But this was a film about the lions who were lying around on the in the blazing hot sun next to this water hole, and they're surrounded by wildebeest or whatever, some ruminant animal that will be their prey. And it's too hot for anybody to go hunting, and it's too hot for anybody to be escaping either. So they all just drink from the water hole and lie around in the sun and hope it cools off sometime soon. And after a couple of days, one or another lion is now hungry enough to be worth the trouble. And he starts looking around, and the wildebeest will move away a little bit. And very gradually, their relationship becomes the prey and the hunter. And then the lion or the lioness takes off after one of them, chases them madly at full gallop for 15 or 20 minutes and doesn't catch them and gives up, goes back, and they lie around and pant and wait for hours. And then the next day they are getting much hungrier, and now it's really worthwhile. Their motivation is higher. And they finally catch one, and while they're ripping it apart and eating it, all the others cluster back in again around the water hole and stand around, and they keep one eye on the lions, but it's just part of their environment again. And when you look at that relationship, even in the most extreme case between the predator and the prey, there's still kind of a benign, mutual acceptance of each other. I mean, of course, this is humanizing them improperly. I have the faintest idea what goes on in the wildebeest's mind or the lion's mind. But it's just astonishing, really, to see that they could be so diametrically opposed, and yet it's not a big deal. It is only a big deal during the hunt, and presumably at the moment of being caught, it's a big deal. But who knows? Maybe the animal goes into shock so fast that it isn't even unpleasant. I don't know. It seems like it must be. And yet, 2 minutes later, they're literally 15 feet away from the lions, chewing on the grass, and the lions are yawning and scratching, and the flies are buzzing, and everything's somnambulant again.
So the artist that puts down his roots can't escape from this reality of the awesome nature before his eyes. That includes everything we would sort of want to dichotomize apart from it, mm-hmm. as the city and our machines. Mm-hmm. Those are just like part of the same old story. So an artist that is broadening his perception and his acceptance of the reality of things, and commented on it in his work, will want to imbue it with this, with all this power and magnificence, and with a sense of wonder and awe. And this is like Paul Klee.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I was thinking of another metaphor in your story about the lions. It's that for an artist, there are cycles like that where you're kind of lying around because for some reason or another, you don't have the motivation, the motivating energy to really like dive into your work. But at a certain point, you get hungry enough. There's something inside you as an artist that you just have to attack the canvas or the clay or whatever you're working
the
with.
The nearest wildebeest.
The nearest wildebeest, right.
And oftentimes it takes cultural, some catastrophe or something that shakes up society to move things forward this way. Because this kind of art we've been bemoaning comes from a kind of a decadent leisure time when there's no...
That's interesting. Yeah.
People are asking to be surprised. You know, please show me something that'll wake me up. And you can't really blame the artists for trying to come up with something that'll wake them up.
And the attention span of people is so much shorter now than it ever. Yes. I mean, you know, back in the days of the great master artists that we've known about for all of these decades and centuries, it wasn't unusual for them to spend a whole year on one painting, or more than a year on one painting. But how often does that happen anymore?
Yeah. I remember a book I read about by this man who builds his own houses and things. And he has this immense long stone wall that would take a team of workers a year to build. And he built it all by himself. And it took him 30 years. Mm. But it's fantastic. It's a beautiful wall. And he just made a point of making sure he put one more stone on it every day. Mm. And it eventually got done.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.